This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Maurice Sendak, one of America's most popular writers and illustrators of children's books. Sendak isn't sentimental about childhood and doesn't see children as adorable innocents. His heroes and heroines are frequently disobedient and have to contend with the demons that haunt childhood. That's made some of Sendak's work very controversial. Some authorities on children's literature warned parents against exposing their children to Sendak's 1963 book, Where the Wild Things Are. They said that Sendak's illustrations of the wild things, which were big-horned, fanged, clawed monsters, would terrify children. Despite the warnings, Where the Wild Things Are is already recognized as a classic of children's literature. It forms a trilogy with his books In the Night Kitchen and Outside Over There. His other popular books include Higgledy Piggledy Pop, Really Rosie, and Kenny's Window. A few years ago, when he was in his early 50s, Sendak began a second career designing stage sets for operas. Maurice Sendak grew up in Brooklyn, New York, with images of two clashing cultures. He learned of a faraway world from his Jewish-Polish emigre father, who told him stories of shtetl life. At the same time, Sendak immersed himself in American popular culture, going to the movies, playing with Mickey Mouse toys, and reading garishly illustrated pulps and comic books. Maurice Sendak lives alone and has no children. He told me that when he was young, adults looked big and grotesque to him, and he couldn't imagine ever becoming one.
It was inconceivable to me as a child that I would be an adult. I mean, one assumed that would happen, but obviously it didn't happen. Or if it did, it happened when your back was turned and then suddenly you were there. So I couldn't have thought about it much.
Because adults seemed really big and different. You couldn't imagine becoming one?
Yeah. I mean, they were mostly dreadful. And if the option were to become an adult was to become another dreadful creature, then best not. Although, I think there had to be a kind of normal anticipation of that moment happening, because being a child was even worse. I mean, being a child was being a child, was being a creature without power, without pocket money, without escape routes of any kind. So I didn't want to be a child. I remember how much, when I was a small boy, I was taken to see a version of Peter Pan. I detested it. I mean, the sentimental idea that anybody would want to remain a boy, I couldn't have thought it out then, but I did later, certainly, that this was a conceit that could only occur in the mind of a very sentimental writer, that any child would want to remain in childhood. It's not possible. The wish is to get out.
Are there any memories that typify your childhood to you now, looking back?
Well, it's typically 30s in many ways, and that a series of long illnesses, but then there were no drugs and there was no penicillin, so kids all ended up having diphtheria, scarlet fever, pneumonia, blah, blah. And I spent a lot of time being sick, as I recollect. And there is the happy memory, actually, of being indoors and watching. The window became my movie camera, my television set. One of the happiest memories I have is when my grandmother would come to stay with us on those occasions, and she would put me on her lap. And then she used the window shade, like a magic lantern. And she'd pull it down, and then I'd hold my breath, and she'd pull it up, and the same thing would be there, a car, or my brother and sister making a snowman, or whatever. So happy memories are being indoors, looking out of windows, and I think it's no accident that windows or children looking out of windows or going through windows or whatever becomes an obsession in most of the books I've written.
A lot of your books deal with the children trying to overcome certain fears, trying to get control of them. What were the things that frightened you when you were a child yourself?
Well, odd things. I don't know if my books are about that, by the way. I mean, they are probably partly that, but I don't set out to write a book that's going to conquer fear or do anything but amuse or entertain or distract the child. But my own fears were very peculiar. I was terrified of the vacuum cleaner. You know, all untraditional. I mean, people sit around saying, well, don't let kids do that and don't let kids do that. It'll be too frightening. But who would have ever imagined anybody saying, don't let a kid in the room with a vacuum cleaner? But when my mother plugged the vacuum cleaner in, and it was those old-fashioned Hoovers, you know, the thing blew up visibly, and the sight of that bag swelling used to just drive me right up the wall, literally. I had to get out of the house, and I was sent to the neighbors until she was all done. The Invisible Man was one of the most terrifying of my nightmares, and I think definitely led me to being an insomniac for the rest of my life.
The movie, The Invisible Man?
The movie with Claude Rains. We were taken to see it, and I remember coming home and being in shock. And it was from that moment on that my sister had to stay with me until I fell asleep, because he could be anywhere in the room. I mean, there was no way you could say, well, you see he's not there, you see he's not there. And my answer would be, well, you can't see him, so what's the big deal? So he was, I mean, even when it's repeated now on Channel 13 in New York, I have a trouble watching that movie. I try to. And the scene where he unravels his head, the bandages, and there's nothing underneath, you know, it's extra Valium that night for me.
Some of the characters in your book defy authority. Were you obedient when you were a kid?
Yeah. Yeah. I wouldn't have had to write about children defying authority if I'd been one of them. So not that I wasn't obedient. I was not a goody-goody child, but I wasn't cantankerous, and I wasn't a revolutionary.
When did you start drawing?
Right away. I mean, as early as I can remember drawing.
Were you encouraged by anyone, your parents or your teachers, to do it and to think of it as a possible livelihood?
Well, I was not discouraged. I knew it would be a livelihood. I mean, I knew from a very early age that I would do books or write stories or draw pictures or something. Mostly encouraged by my siblings. I'm the youngest of three, and my brother is 5 years older than I am, my sister 9, and there they were doing books. And, you know, when you're the youngest, you're going to do everything that the others, the older ones, are doing. And happily, not only did I want to ape them, but I had an inclination and a gift. So we all did it together. So drawing and writing and storytelling was a family preoccupation.
How did it get to be children's books that you did?
Willy-nilly, because I didn't know how else to categorize me. I mean, where do you put somebody who has a book where the pig talks and monsters appear, not on the same shelf with Norman Mailer. So you put it on a kiddie bookshelf. And since the books were not written for children consciously, I don't know how to write for children. I don't know what children like or dislike. It's always been a little odd that I've been so particularly characterized as a children's book writer. I've accepted it. It's perfectly fine. I mean, kids as an audience are much more Catholic in taste and candid a group than grown-ups. I prefer them. But I don't prefer being pigeonholed, and I don't prefer having my work reduced to only being a book for children.
You have three books which you consider your trilogy, mm-hmm. Where the Wild Things Are, The Night Kitchen, and Outside Over There. Are there any themes that you think of holding these three books together as a trilogy?
I think so, very, very clearly to me. And one of them, there are any number of them, but one of them, which is most obvious, is that they all have to do with a brief, inadvertent moment in a child's life. What happens? Kids are safe indoors, and Mama turns her back for a minute, or Papa turns his back for a minute. Nothing big, no great shriek, no accident. It's more a mental state. It's more an emotional moment which goes by unheard. These are loving parents. These are not weird parents. But they're parents who have to turn their backs for a second. Life does take them up, too, occasionally. And in that second, the kid has to make a decision all by him or herself without the experience, which we have as adults, or the logic that tells them what to do. So they have to figure it out very quick, and often they come up with very ludicrous and illogical conclusions to a situation. And all three of the children in these three books do, in fact, face such a moment by themselves and have to decide what to do.
In Where the Wild Things Are, a young boy is sent up to his room without supper, and he's really angry at his mother, so he decides to leave home and go to where the wild things are, and he becomes king of the wild things. And the wild things are these wonderful monsters or beasts that you've created. What inspired the shape and the faces, the bodies of the monsters?
Well, there was a lot of work on that, and I didn't want them to be traditional monsters, like griffins and gorillas and such like. I wanted them to be very, very personal. They had to come out of my own particular life. And I remember it took a very long time until that gestation occurred and where they began to appear on drawing paper and they began to be what I liked. And it was only when I had them all that I realized they were all my Jewish relatives. They were all the adults who treated us in such silly fashions when we were kids. And these were the real monsters of my childhood. You know, people come on Sunday and wait to get fed, uncles and aunts, and you get all dressed up and you have to sit and listen to their tedious conversation when you want to be with your brother and sister and listening to the radio or whatever, and they all say the same dumb thing, or you're beating time till food gets put on the table, how big you are and how fat you got, and you look so good we can eat you up. In fact, we knew they would, because my mother was the slowest cooker in Brooklyn, so if she didn't hurry up, they would eat us up. So the only entertainment was watching their bloodshot eyes and how bad their teeth were. You know, children are monstrously cruel about physical defects. So my entertainment was to examine them closely. You know, the huge nose and the hair curling out of the nose and the weird mole on the side of the head. And so you would glue in on that, and then you'd talk about it with your brother and sister later. And they became the Wild Things.
One of the things I love about the monsters in the book is that they're really goofy. I mean, they're not really frightening. Okay, granted, I'm an adult, but still, there's something really kind of goofy and playful and big and floppy about them.
But at the same time, they are threatening. I mean, if Max were not in control of them, they could indeed be in control of him. And when they say, oh, please don't go, we'll eat you up, we love you so, they mean just that. And he knows that. And I think children know that, too, that the fun of that book is a perilous tightrope between him being a little boy and very vulnerable to these huge creatures and the absurdity of his having control over them by staring into their yellow eyes. It's what every child would like, to have control over such things. Kids are not afraid of them because Max is not afraid of them. And if, see, the kids glue in onto Max right away and they follow him. And if he's okay, they're okay. And people who think kids might be afraid of that book don't perceive how children look at books. Now, I sound as though I'm very much involved in doing a children's book, which contradicts what I said earlier. But in fact, I don't do it for children, but I have an instinct for children, which comes out in my work. There's no question about that. And an obsession with childhood, my own childhood, which comes out in my work. And it's valid because it's the source of my inspiration.
When Where the Wild Things came out, it was very controversial, and a lot of adults and libraries were afraid that it would scare kids. And I wonder if that was ever a serious thought for you. I know what you said about them seeing it through Max's point of view, but given what you said about The Invisible Man and how much that movie scared you, have you ever been afraid that one of your books would leave kids with the same kind of fear that The Invisible Man left with you?
It's conceivable. I mean, one cannot foresee how that will happen. What I hope is that if a book is frightening to a child, then you take the book away. Little girl screams, and you know she doesn't like the book. I mean, we do not inflict pain on children. And even though the book has won an award, and even though the book is this, kids are not impressed. If they like it, they like it. If they don't, they don't. I had to sit through The Invisible Man because they paid my ticket. I sit to the end of the movie. But in fact, a book can be slammed shut, and you could be spared another moment of fear.
Were there any pictures that, I don't mean moving pictures, but paintings or photographs or illustrations that scared you when you were young?
Well, that's what we talked about earlier. It's a very unwitting thing. You don't know what will trigger. That's why it's useless trying to protect children. I mean, my father took me to see Charlie Chaplin because he adored Charlie Chaplin, and I screamed because he frightened me. So he moved in such a weird robot way. I saw nothing funny. Well, who could possibly have imagined a kid being afraid of Charlie Chaplin? So, moral of the story is, we all take our chances. There's just no way of knowing what's going to trigger that.
The Night Kitchen, which is the second book of your trilogy. When the book came out, Mickey, who's the main character mm-hmm. in it, is nude during part mm-hmm. of it. And I understand that there were librarians who actually blocked up the little infant penis so that children wouldn't be exposed to it.
He had to wear little dighties or diapers or shorts before they let the book into the library.
Now, I was really surprised because I thought that, as much fear as people have in our society of nakedness, that I thought infant nakedness was okay.
Well, we live in a very strange society. I mean, I was outraged when that book came out, and there was such a hullabaloo over his genitals. I mean, I assumed everybody knew little boys had that and that this wasn't a breakthrough. The fact that people considered that outrageous, incredible. I mean, you go to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, you go to the Frick, you go to the Philadelphia Museum of Art, and there's a Christ child with his penis. It's accepted in fine art, but somehow in books for children there's a taboo. Well, the hell with that. I mean, I didn't set out to cause a scandal. I set out to do a very particular work where he had to be naked in order to confront a particular dream he was in. You don't go into a dream wearing Fruit of the Loom underwear or PJs. You go tuto, you go yourself, your being. And that's why he was naked. And it was idiocy. It was incredible idiocy what went on over that book for many, many years about Mickey being naked.
The third book in your trilogy, Outside Over There, is about an infant who's kidnapped by goblins and is rescued by his big sister.
Her big sister.
That's her big sister, yeah. When I was a kid, we were always warned that certain people would kidnap you, and I think that fear has escalated a lot more since I was young. Did you grow up in the Lindbergh kidnapping
period? Yes, I did, and that book is a kind of, if you can say it, homage to the Lindbergh kidnapping and the anxiety that provoked in me as a child. But more than that, it's a primal anxiety that children have, whether they live through the Lindbergh kidnapping or any real kidnapping in the real world. The true anxiety is, will I be taken away? Will my parents be taken away? When Papa goes to work, does he really come back at night? If Mama leaves, how do I know she's going to come back into the room? These are of intense concern to children, of course. I mean, they can't manage by themselves, and they know that. And that's what it's about. It's not about the Lindbergh kidnapping. It's about the terrible feeling of being abandoned. Now, that book has had the most controversy of all the three, and it is the book that's having the most troubled course in its life. And it's hard for me to know why, except I suspect that anxiety is so much of human nature, is so part of our lives, that some people just simply don't want to consider it at all. And again, they think best to protect their children from such visions. When, if my theories hold up, and I think they do after 30 years, children have these visions whether you protect them from it or not. And an outside over there, at least, unlike real life, I give it a happy ending. I mean, I revive Charlie Lindbergh Jr. and bring him back in the form of a little girl baby at the end of that book. But it was a very important book to, not simply because of the abandonment idea, but the complex feeling of an older child in relation to taking care of a younger child. I lived with one. My 9-year-old sister had to take care of me, and she loved me, but there were moments when she didn't love me at all and wished me dead. And I think that is another normal and has to be accepted as a normal attitude of children. It's not something to be frightened of. It's just something we must get used to and live with.
I want to quote what you write when the older sister goes out the window in search of her baby sister. You write, she climbed backwards out her window into outside over there. And that whole image really reminds me of so many dreams that I've had where suddenly I'm in this unfamiliar territory and I'm totally disoriented. I have no bearings. I don't know where I am or what direction to go into, and even have trouble moving. Is that based on dream imagery that you had?
Well, it's based on dream states of helplessness. And she is, Ida, at that very moment, is in a helpless condition. She makes it, I think it says in the book, she makes a serious mistake. The serious mistake is being in a helpless condition. and once you start and once you start out wrong, being backwards, not looking in the right place, then you're really wrong for a while. And it's only her father's song when she's in midair and her love for her father that brings her back and snaps her back into the right direction and gives her back the strength of body and mind which she was deprived of in that dream nightmare moment to save her baby sister, which is, of course, was just what she intended to do all the time. It's her fantasy. I mean, Max on The Wild Things takes 2 seconds. It all occurs in 2 seconds. He's not deprived of his dinner for more than maybe a quarter of an hour. And Ida's mother, who is mourning the loss of her husband who just went to sea and just was not interested in her children for a second. And my point is, mamas have a right to not be interested for a few minutes when they're really struggling with something that the children can't understand. Well, in those few minutes, Ida just had a fit. But the whole kidnapping and flying and everything occurred in just minutes. And in the end, she's back with her mama and a letter from her papa. This is a theme that does obsess me, is the fragility of moments of childhood, of life. It happens now. It doesn't happen just when we're children, when we need to be comforted, when we need to be told that we're loved and that we need to be held physically. It doesn't stop because we grow up. And outside over there was the most personal vision, was the most personal putting down on paper what that felt like.
Is the series over now? You've explored those
ideas
in the three books.
Yes, it is over. Yes, it is over indeed. I mean, I, I hope to do more books and more picture books, but that triumvirate, which had been in my head for almost 30 years, is finished.
My guest is artist and writer Maurice Sendak. When your father was 75, you had asked him if he would write a book and offered to illustrate it yourself. What led you to make that offer? What made you think that your father had a book in him?
Well, I knew my father had a book in him. My father was the kind of man who felt being an artist was slightly embarrassing, that it wasn't the proper work for a man, really. And he had an ingenious imagination, which had been almost entirely repressed during his entire life, because he had to earn a living and bring up his children and come to America and do all the things that immigrants did. And there wasn't time. Art was fooling around. It wasn't really making a living, which is why he was so anxious that I and my brother were becoming artists as a profession. He worried about how he would do it, sort of gypsy work, so far as he was concerned. So he never would see that the stories he told us and that his imagination was symptomatic of where we got it from. He wouldn't ever have endorsed that, and he wouldn't have ever put it down. But what happened was after my mother died, he literally began to die. I mean, he decided he did not want to live after her. So we had him for only a year, and in that year, I was determined to have something of his literally down. And so I encouraged him during the years he was slowly dying, the year, to write the story. He was in the hospital a good deal of the time in New York City, where I was too. And part of our work together during that time was his writing his story in Yiddish in a notebook. And I'd come visit him and I'd translate at his bedside. And lo and behold, to our amazement, and genuinely so, I showed it to my editor at Harper's and she bought it. And so he had the great pleasure of knowing before his death that he was going to be a published writer. And it's just been published, and it's like an enormous burden off my back to finish that piece.
The book opens with him talking about how he left Poland for America. Did you learn anything about your father's personal life from working with him on the book?
Oh, sure. Well, he told us all the time about his life. We were always asking questions about their lives in Europe, both my father and mother. My grandfather, who I never knew, his father, and my grandmother, his mother, and all his brothers and sisters had a large family, were reasonably well-to-do. His father was a big chief in the little village, and he traded in timber, and he was a rabbi, and my father was the youngest prized son, and came to America on a whim. I mean, he was chasing a girl, quite simply. And I think my father's grief was that he came for such a shallow, whimsical reason, and his entire family was destroyed during the war. I mean, I think he felt very guilty his entire life that he wasn't with them. And this little story in Grandpa's house, if you read between the lines, is looking for forgiveness from his parents for not having been with them when they needed him. He's looking for his parents all during the story. My father never got over the fact that he wasn't with his parents when they died, and that his brothers and sisters and his nephews and nieces, his children were growing up and his sons were having bar mitzvahs and they were not. And that was a cloud that hung over us all during our lives.
Well, how did that guilt that he had express itself in his relationship to you?
Anger at what we had sometimes. Anger that we didn't understand until much later. Arrogance. We expected this and we expected that, but he knew there were children who could not have it, his brother's children. It was more than we as children could ever understand. In fact, we were very irritated with those Jews over there who never had anything because they were constantly held up to us. And only later did we understand, and only later did I try to make it up for him. And the pictures in his book, and when I illustrated Isaac Singer's book, I peopled it with all those brothers and sisters from old photographs to give them back to my father, even if only as pictures for an Isaac Singer story.
My guest is artist and writer Maurice Sendak. Can I ask you what books made the most impression on you when you were growing up?
Mickey Mouse and Pygmy Land was the first book. I adored it. It's funny, I almost stopped at that. My sister bought me that book.
Was it the pictures that were
It was the pictures and the story. I didn't know it was a rip-off Gulliver's Travel, that's Mickey being in a place where they tie him up and walk all over him. It's a great book. Books were objects as well as their content. If I like the way they look, like I remember I drove my father crazy until he bought me a copy of Robin Hood, which I saw in the stationery shop in Brooklyn, in Bensonhurst. And the reason I wanted it, it had a beautiful, shiny white cover with Errol Flynn on the cover in his Robin Hood uniform because the movie had just come out. And I saw that. And I'd seen the movie, and I just had to have that book. And it was 50 cents. I remember it. And I literally drove him mad. I didn't care how mad he got. I just besieged him and battered him down until I still have that copy. It meant so much to me to have that book and that jacket. And then when I read it, or it was read to me, I was allowed to sniff the paper because the paper, the smell of cheap paper, just, that was my fix. And I've always thought, when I smell books that have that smell, I think that's Sherwood Forest.
When you grew up in Brooklyn, you really wanted to go to Manhattan, right?
Mm, sure.
And then after you were adult and lived in Manhattan, what did you do? You turned around and you moved to the country.
Yes. Well, I was in Manhattan from the age of 17 to 40. That's a goodly long time to survive New York.
Why'd you want to get out, though?
Well, I got sick. I had a major coronary when I was 39. And it wasn't so much that I wanted to leave New York. It was advised that I leave New York for my health's sake. So I moved to the country. And what the doctors hadn't told me was how, if you can survive the first year in the country, then you're probably going to live a long life after your coronary. They don't tell you how frightening it is to buy a house and fix a house and be alone, you know. They'd all seen the same movies I had where Bette Davis and Margaret Sullivan went to live in the country.
Can you just share with us some of the favorite comments, some of your favorite comments from readers, adults and children, that you've gotten over the years?
Oh, there's so many. Can I give you just one?
Sure, yeah.
That right. I really, really like. Okay. It was from a boy, a little boy. And he wrote me a charming little card with a little drawing. I loved it. I answer all my children's letters, but sometimes very hastily. But this one I lingered over, and I sent him a postcard, and I did a picture of a wild thing on the postcard. And I said, "Dear Jim, I loved your card," something to that effect. Then I got a letter back from his mother, and she said, "Jim loved your card so much, he ate it." That to me was the highest compliment. The child loves something so much that it must be incorporated into the body. And that was emblematic of the most gorgeous compliment, actually. He didn't care it was an original drawing or anything. He saw it, he loved it, he ate it. I love that.
That was writer and illustrator Maurice Sendak. His books include Where the Wild Things Are, In the Night Kitchen, and Outside Over There. Recently, Maurice Sendak illustrated new editions of The Nutcracker and The Cunning Little Vixen. Fresh Air is a production of WHYY Radio in Philadelphia. The engineer for this edition was Jay Goldman. Fresh Air is edited by Maeve McGoran. Amy Salad is the associate producer. Danny Miller and I co-produce the show. My name's Terry Gross, and I want to thank you for listening.
National distribution of Fresh Air is made possible with the financial support of listeners to WHYY-FM, Philadelphia. Additional funding comes from National Public Radio member stations and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.